Now let's catch our breath here and emphasize a few major characteristics of an objective. Remember these points. A specified objective will make it possible for you to focus your planning with greater precision. An objective will enable you to assess the results of your efforts on the job. Sometimes an objective is so large in scope and so distant in time that you'll be working on it for a very long time. Let's say that your company has a goal of putting a countertop carbon dioxide laser into 50,000 offices to be used as automatic typescript erasers. Now, the company might even specify that it wants to achieve that goal in 10 years. Now, there's nothing wrong with the goal, as far as the company is concerned, but it is a large objective with a long time span. What about the shorter-term objectives leading to that end result? One short-term goal in that context might be to first create a laser that does the job and will cost, say, between $10 and $25 to the customer. Then you go on from there to other intermediate objectives. Most objectives, particularly large ones, can be so broken down into sub-objectives or sub-goals. Now, these are sometimes called intermediate goals. The long-range or very-end objective can be broken down into one-year objectives or shorter than that. The point is that it always helps to build in smaller steps when you're doing your planning so that you can pause at these way stations and find out where you are and how far you have yet to go. It's a kind of programming that can make your life a lot easier. By breaking any objective down into more manageable chunks, you facilitate planning. It gives you realistic reference points rather than waiting until the end of 5 years to assess whether or not the objective has been reached. Even within 1 year, you may find that it helps to establish sub-objectives that are derived from the year's objectives. You might have a long-range objective, for instance, of increasing sales of a computer-buffered alphanumeric graphic display terminal used with Composer hookup by 18% over the previous year. Now, this can be broken down into quarterly objectives and related to market conditions. Perhaps this terminal is more heavily in demand in the summer than other times of the year. If so, your second and third quarter sales objective should reflect this and be higher than the first and fourth quarter sales goals. Together, all quarters may average out to an 18% sales increase for the year. Now, this method of breaking down objectives into sub-objectives or intermediate objectives helps you establish benchmarks along the way so you will have a more precise fix on your rate of progress towards your goal. Another advantage of having sub-objectives is that you'll know before you run out of time whether your objective can be achieved. You'll also be able to rectify any trouble that might crop up without having to give up the terminal objective. There's nothing unchangeable about an objective. When you establish one, it's based on the best information available at the time. It's also based on your assumptions about conditions you encounter during the year. But conditions inside and outside your company can and often do change. Now, this is especially true in scientific and engineering fields. A NASA cutback or reduced defense spending can, unfortunately, change conditions radically. Or perhaps new information that affects your plans comes to light after you have established your objective. Whatever the cause, objectives will occasionally have to be modified. Sub-objectives, by giving you partial readings on your progress along the way, enable you to detect more quickly possible changes that could alter your major objective. Setting objectives that are clear, measurable, and with time targets is only the first step in planning. Saying that you plan to be in the Hotel Americana in New York City for that IEEE convention by 6 p.m. on March 30th is a precise objective, to be sure. But it doesn't indicate what you have to do in order to arrive at that destination by the time you've established. Now just think of the specific steps needed to reach the Hotel Americana. Will it be by car, train, plane, subway, what? How about rooming? You'll need necessary reservations, of course. And just what are you going to pack in your suitcase, including which papers to be presented at the convention? All such steps carried out on schedule will make it possible for you to reach your destination on time. In this case, you're not likely to write down specific activities with the conditions for achieving them, although some people will do that. But with larger objectives, it's a good idea to write everything down in chart form. In either case, you may want to develop contingency plans which you can fall back on. Alternate routes to the same goal is what helps systems engineering to succeed on schedule where haphazard plans fail. Now let's see how this works. Suppose, as recruitment officer of your company, you are asked to hire 25 young engineers because your company has been fortunate to get a nice plump government contract in pollution control. What kind of intermediate steps must be taken? You draw up a list of kinds of engineers needed. You find out what the effective date of employment is for these respective men or women. You determine what salary ranges are permissible, and so on. In contrast to setting up these intermediate steps, it would be folly, wouldn't it, simply to start flying from college to college next Monday without any kind of preparation? An action step describes something you must do to move toward an objective. An action step contains a strong verb, like talk, write, call, meet, develop. Verbs like understand, know, feel, think are not strong verbs. Moreover, they are wide open to philosophical interpretation and therefore not easily observable or measurable. So stay away from them. Suppose you had the responsibility to train 30% of the total number of supervisors in your plant in fundamentals of performance evaluation by the end of the next calendar year. What kinds of action steps might contribute towards this objective? For example, to list by name at the next meeting with division managers which 30% will be trained first. Did you hear the action verb? Action steps, when well laid out, enable you to visualize a step-by-step progression toward your objective. Action steps, like sub-objectives, can give you a sense of movement toward a goal. Also, like sub-objectives, action steps can give you clues as to whether you will need to change your objective. If an action step takes longer than planned, you may have to make some changes in your schedule. To specify action steps required to accomplish an objective, we'll also provide you with the means to identify and designate responsibility and accountability for carrying out required actions. From actions you specify, you'll find those that you must personally do. You'll find others that can be delegated. Your colleagues will be able to see their shared role in accomplishing your common objective. This process can make a fairly routine action take on significance. If others understand the actions they must accomplish to achieve an objective, their actions then become meaningful. Let's consider this process of communicating actions, along with objectives, as a method of motivating others. Quite an important matter. Once objectives are specified, and you have delegated precise responsibilities to others, it is desirable to set up a control system to assure that those functions are carried out as required. It ought to be apparent that our successful space accomplishments were programmed with elaborate monitor systems built into them, so that at any stage, mission control knew exactly what was happening to both men and machines in space. You should also be prepared to adjust actions to meeting changing conditions. Whenever possible, develop contingency plans. It is highly desirable to plan as many alternate methods for obtaining the objective as you can. In other words, put in as much redundancy as possible. This is true not only of information systems, but of short and long-term planning. Okay, now let's try to sum up some of the points we've mentioned about management by objectives. 1. An objective is a specific description of a goal or result you intend to achieve. 2. A project, responsibility, or action step will answer the question who will do what by when. 3. Contingency plans are alternate projects, responsibilities, or action steps that can be taken to obtain the objectives. These are some fundamentals of a process that lends itself to engineering management. It sometimes is called management by objectives, or management by results, or by some other description. In any case, the process contains within it elements that are necessary for effective management planning. These elements can be summed up as planning, leading, and controlling. It is a planning process because it helps you organize and lay out work. It is a leading process because you invite subordinates to participate and you gain their support for carrying out the work. It is a control process because you monitor performance and advance the job effectively for you and the people reporting to you. It can make your life a lot easier in all forms of engineering management. And now a word about that most vital part of any management function, personal communication. Whether you must communicate with those below you or must communicate with those above you, knowing the nature of successful communication and some barriers to achieving the same can help you do a better job. Whether you have as a project the design of a turbine or a development of a new component, you have to communicate results to someone else, or someone else has to communicate them to you. Whether you have to give a talk at the IEEE convention or in your own plant, or whether you are in the audience listening, understanding some principles of communication can forward your advance within your own organization, and more importantly, give you an insight into mankind's most distinctively human characteristic. The engineer who is a genius in the design of microwave transmission but cannot communicate too clearly what he has designed is a genius, but not in the world at large. It is often apparent that top management more easily recognizes solid accomplishments when the inventor has a clear grasp of fundamentals of human communication. But what are these? The model that Claude Charron worked out for telephone transmission is useful in the study of human communication also. Simply put, it involves, on one end, a sender of a message. He encodes the message in some form, such as print, pictures, or human voice. He transmits it in some manner, whether person to person, by letter, or by hand. On the other end, there is a receiver of the message who must, in some way, decode it and act on it. Now, nothing is more important to remember than that communication is a two-way process and that even listening is an action in response to a message. Noise can determine, in part, the reception of the message. Noise can be actual, such as static, but it can also be symbolic to include elements that prevent the clear understanding of the message. Now, for instance, if you were in the audience, say, of a conference at the IEEE convention where a speaker from a foreign country was giving a talk, some of the noise might be his heavy dialect, or it could be your own thought of your boy's upcoming Little League game intruding on your concentration. But how does all this apply to you? While this simple construct cannot predict results in communication, it can help you analyze past failures and successes. If your memo to a superior about a research study you have done was sent back with certain phrases underlined and question marks attached, or if you never heard of any action being taken on your memo, then you could conclude that your act of communication was less than successful. Which brings us to the two overriding considerations in any act of communication. One is knowing what you want to achieve, and the second is understanding how you can best reach your audience. What you want to achieve by your communication is not often specified and accounts for much of the difficulty. Do your memos to subordinates clearly indicate the kind of action you wish them to take? A worker who has been absent too often may receive a memo from you expressing your feelings about the matter, but not clearly indicating just what it is you wish the recipient to do. Do you wish him to send in an explanation of certain absences? Do you wish him to avoid any future absences without notifying you in advance? Such follow-up actions should be clearly indicated. Now, as for knowing the audience to be reached, that is of major consequence. Your talk to a group of parents at the PTA meeting about a new way to manufacture industrial diamonds might be a way over their heads. Similarly, a memo to subordinates on the need to raise the cost of ceramic insulators because the cost per ton of rare earth materials has gone up could be lost upon those persons, not necessarily because of the difficulty or abstruseness of the subject matter, but because it has no apparent connection with a subordinate's interest or perhaps their jobs. Knowing why you want to communicate and knowing as much as you can about the audience who will receive the message will determine what medium you plan to use. It is not always wise to write a memo when a simple chart could be more effective to get your message across. As a matter of fact, one could use this tape as an instance of choosing a medium to communicate with an audience about a rather large topic in a reasonably effective way. The broad kind of actions we, as originators of this message, expect of you, the audience, is another matter, and we leave it to your guesses as to those possibilities. There are all sorts of barriers to effective communication. Some are physical, some intellectual, and many psychological. To give one kind of barrier, time often makes effective communications difficult. For instance, your feasibility study for a new product might be just great, but it's so wordy you are placing a burden on your boss to expect him to read it through. Few types of writing cannot be pruned without altering either your message or your purpose, except for the better. Winston Churchill insisted that anything his colleagues had to say that was worth saying could be put on one sheet of paper. Another kind of barrier is inherent in the great number of backgrounds and educational preparation you are exposed to as a manager. The computer trainee under you may have a high school education or less. He may find your level of vocabulary difficult to comprehend. Your memos could fail to achieve their purpose unless they are worded with this in mind. There is a language barrier also. Each branch of engineering has increasingly become more specialized and has developed its own jargon. This being the case, and since management itself is rapidly becoming a field in itself, it behooves you to translate often when you communicate with such management, especially when you are interested in advancement. There are more subtle barriers to effective communication. Sometimes management attempts to advertise its own special status indicated by the proverbial private key to the men's room. A gap may exist between such rarefied echelons and those who prefer to remain engineers. If it does, then you will recognize the awe with which many an engineer has been ushered into a large and imposing office and been asked to sit down near a secretary's desk much larger and more affluent than his own. Whatever your place in this picture, you can minimize the friction by at least being aware that it exists. While we could say much more about factors that muddy successful communication, it can be seen that we are all products of our backgrounds, our interests, and our personal attitudes, and that these affect what we say and do with others. You want to keep that in mind next time you want to communicate with another person. This concludes the MP program.